Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Here's the truth about Jeanette Walls' childhood. Her father was brilliant, affectionate, and passionate about sharing his deep love of math and science with Walls and her three siblings. Her mother, an artist with a teaching degree, was known for treating her students with particular sensitivity and tried to create in her own children an unyielding confidence in their own specialness and their ability to thrive independently. Both of them approached life as free spirits with big dreams. But it's also true that her parents' dreams never came true, often because of their own mistakes. Walls' father was frequently and sometimes furiously drunk. Her mother was more inclined to paint or write than cook for her children, and neither of her parents managed to stay employed for long. As a result, they moved constantly and were sometimes homeless, living at various points in an old train depot, a series of relatives' homes, and finally in a leaking shack without indoor plumbing, tucked into a sunless hollow in small-town West Virginia. Walls' best-selling memoir, The Glass Castle, acknowledges and even embraces these contradictions in her youth, painting a family portrait surprisingly free of bitterness and also of the remarkable resilience that she was able to draw from it. The book has sold more than 4 million copies in 31 languages since its initial publication a decade ago and has been widely used as a nonfiction text in schools. It was temporarily removed from Highland Park's approved reading list this school year after a parent complained it contained inappropriate content. Eventually, the text was reapproved, and Walls chose not to cancel her previously scheduled appearance at the Highland Park Literary Festival, where, in fact, she is scheduled tonight to speak as the keynote address. Jeanette Walls, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me here.
You have been so gracious about the temporary suspension of your book from Highland Park, saying that it's a good thing that parents care. Did it rankle you at all, though, that someone felt that the story of the life that you actually lived was inappropriate for teenagers to even read about?
No, not at all. I completely get it. If a parent just thought, gosh, this might hurt my child. I don't want them to be exposed to this scary stuff. There are things about my childhood that were pretty horrible. And the fact that it's true doesn't somehow indemnify it. I mean, if I'd been a hooker or something like that, it'd be appropriate. But it's interesting. I mean, I think that they're in an effort to protect our children. What is the smartest way to do that? And some people think remove all the bad things from their lives, keep these negative influences away. And then there's another school of thought, let's introduce these bad things in a controlled environment and show them how to deal with it themselves. And I'm obviously of the latter school. So I was concerned initially, not anger with the parent, but just sort of, you know, in all modesty, my story has helped some people. And I would hate for there to become a trend in which parents see it as a damaging text, where parents say, this is an evil, ugly book. Let's keep our kids away from it. And I'm overjoyed by the reaction, not just by other parents, but by students as well. They came forward and they said, we think that it's important for us to be exposed to this sort of stuff. Now, how gorgeous is that? That's democracy at work. You know, that a parent has absolutely every right to say, I'm worried that my child being exposed to this will be damaging. And then another parent says, I disagree with you. And then a dialogue gets going. And that's what it's about. And I'm so delighted by the outcome that I think that the whole thing has only been for the best. And I think it's been a valuable lesson for me. And I think it's even a more valuable lesson for the kids to stand up for what you believe in. If a decision is made, even by an authority figure, that is ostensibly in your interest, that you disagree with it in an intelligent, articulate, compassionate, thoughtful way, and you will be heard. And what a wonderful lesson that is.
You were a voracious reader as a kid. Talk about some of the kinds of books that you were drawn to.
I read everything I could get my hands on. One of my very favorite early books was A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. And I was pretty much friendless. I wasn't very cute. I certainly wasn't popular. But I could read, and I loved writing. And the main character in A Tree Grows in Brooklyn wasn't very cute. She wasn't very popular, but she could read and loved writing. And that's what got her through these tough times. The main character in A Tree Grows in Brooklyn also had a drop-dead drunk daddy who she loved. And making that emotional connection with a fictional character was very powerful to me. My second favorite book after A Tree Grows in Brooklyn was probably The Grapes of Wrath. And here was a family that was even worse off than my family. And it gave me hope. And that is part of the power of literature, is to make these emotional connections. And I hope that my story has done that for some other kids. And I have to tell you, one of the ironies of my appearance here and of some objections to my book is that there's some concern that these children in Highland Park, they're so well-to-do, and they can't be exposed to these scary things in my story. I spoke to some of the students today in an assembly, and several of them wanted to talk to me afterwards about problems that they're going through. And the details are very different, but they found an emotional connection. They found some similarity between what I went through and what they're going through, and they wanted to talk to me about where can I find the strength? How can I get through this? And that's what it's all about. It's not about literary prizes or bestsellers for me anymore. It's about getting these people who think they're alone, who think that nobody will understand. If I can do for those kids what A Tree Grows in Brooklyn did for me, I will die a happy woman. That's what it's about. It's about sharing our stories. I think that so many of us, we erect these facades to pretend that we are different from other people. And me with my old white trash background, I come to a lovely area like Highland Park and I find kindred spirits. And they might have very different, the details of their lives might be different. But if we can strike an emotional chord and understand, you know, we're going through all this together, that's a beautiful thing. And that is why we tell our stories. And I think that is why the good folk at Highland Park, both the parents and the administrators, as well as the kids, all banded together and say, let's make this happen.
There's a story that I love from The Glass Castle, and it's when you have a friend from school when you're living in West Virginia, and maybe by appearances, her family is just as bad off as yours. Her mother is reputed to be a prostitute, and you're just like sort of salaciously curious about this, not in a mean way, but you want to know what it's like, you know, to meet a prostitute. And you go expecting one thing, and then her mom's very kind to you, and she like makes a fuss over you and feeds you her special sandwich, which sounds pretty gross, but it sounds like you were really hungry and it tasted good to you. Uh-huh. And I read that scene and I was struck by the fact that I have to imagine you're hoping that people are willing to look at your family from one view and then see sort of behind that closed door there was something else also going on.
Chris, I love it that you loved that story because that is so much of what I try to preach these days is looking behind the facade, looking beyond the exterior, the stereotypes that we make about crazy homeless people or shallow gossip columns or whatever. There's always a deeper story. We jump to conclusions about people because it's comfortable, because it's easy to stereotype. But people are so much more complicated. And if you give them a chance and you listen to their stories, everybody has a story. One of my favorite things in the world to do whenever I come to Newtown is talk to the cab driver, the taxi driver who picks me up. And I love hearing people's stories. And these anonymous people who pick you up, by the end, you can be a friend if you are willing to listen to the story.
What do you ask them?
How did you start driving a taxi? How long have you been doing this? If they're a native of this area. And at first, they sometimes get a little bit cagey. But by the end, I always have a friend. I always have a new friend. And you learn so much about the power of overcoming obstacles. So many people, they see me and they'll say, oh, they'll read my story and they say, I can't believe what you pulled yourself up from. It's so amazing. I can't believe anybody. There are so many stories like mine around. There are just so many people who go around hiding these things. And so often after I give a talk, somebody will come up to me. And they'll wait till the crowds are gone, and they'll start sharing their story with me. And sometimes they start crying. Sometimes it's somebody who's 30, 40, 50 years old, and they say, I've never told anybody this story before, but I think you'll understand. And they'll tell me this amazing story about triumph and survival, and they see it as a source of shame. And I get it, because I used to feel that way about my story. And that's part of the magic of storytelling, is that once one person tells their story, it emboldens other people to tell theirs. And I hear these great stories, and I can't figure out whether I want to smack the person or hug them for being ashamed of this. But as I said, I get it. And so many of us walk around with these stories thinking it makes us inferior. When, if you have any perspective on somebody else's story, usually you admire the person for going through what they did. But a lot of us have survivor's guilt.
You held on to maybe survivor's guilt. Certainly you tried very hard. You know, you made your way to Barnard and you got a great job and you started moving up in your career. What did it feel like knowing that you had that secret? And were you afraid that someone was going to find you out when your job at the time was sort of telling the secrets that celebrities didn't want?
I was terrified. I was terrified, and shame on me. I was there was irony to it, and that's a nice word for hypocrisy. It was appalling that I had dedicated my career to telling other people's secrets while I was hiding my own. And I sort of rationalized it. I wrote about celebrities for a living, and it's so ironic to me because, you know, I grew up without a television. I didn't know who these people were, but that was the beat I was given. Mm-hmm. And so I decided I'm going to do the best job that I can. And initially it was about the rich and powerful and the movers and shakers and the Donald Trumps and the media and the politics and stuff like that. And then they moved me on to celebrities. And I thought it was sort of democratizing information. You know, the rich and famous, they have problems just like the rest of us. Let's look behind the facade. But on another level, it is schadenfreude. And then another level, I was just trying to make fun of rich, famous people. And it's cheap and easy. And yeah, I lived in constant fear that somebody would find this out. And I did try to write my story a couple of times before I finally went ahead and committed it to paper. And the first time I tried to fictionalize it, and I couldn't figure out what I was supposed to change. Was it supposed to make it weirder or less weird, more wacky? It was just all so crazy. Anyway, and it felt disingenuous to be writing about some fictional woman who's got fictional homeless parents. So I had to sort of go ahead and commit it to paper. And then I was terrified. Even after I finished it, I was completely convinced I'd get fired from my job and I'd become a complete pariah. It was sort of professional suicide, I thought, that I would be unhirable and that nobody would want to know me. And one of the many lessons that I hope that I've learned is I underestimated people. People are good and kind. But I went around so prepared to be looked down on and to be held in contempt. I'm a fighter and a scrapper, and you look at me cross-eyed, I'll take you out. And I was prepared for that. What I was unprepared for was the compassion and the understanding. And it was such a life changer for me that people, they get it. They get it sort of more than I did. People have asked me, how could I possibly forgive my parents for the way I was raised? The person I had to forgive was myself. And I think that a lot of people who've pulled themselves up by the bootstraps feel that way. How do you stay true to your roots but better yourself? It's a challenge, but I think that if you try to deny your roots, you can never be fully who it is that you want to be.
It almost feels like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, like you could have clicked your heels together at any point, but you had to be ready. You had to make that journey first.
That's absolutely true. I had to be able, I had to have the perspective and to see my parents for the very complicated people that they are. Nobody's all bad and nobody's all good. You know, you mentioned some of my father's lovely qualities, but he was an alcoholic as well. And he always promised that he would build us this glass castle. And I kind of believed him on some level. Only once I was able to let go of the mythology was I able to sort of see the beauty as well.
My guest is author Jeanette Walls. Her books include The Glass Castle, Half Broke Horses, and The Silver Star. She's the keynote speaker at tonight's Highland Park Literary Festival. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. SMU Summer Youth has hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration opens March 3rd at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Jeanette Walls. Her 2005 memoir, The Glass Castle, has sold 4 million copies and counting. She also has novels including Half-Broke Horses and The Silver Star, and she is the keynote speaker tonight at the Highland Park Literary Festival. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. It's occurred to me, Jeanette, that you didn't rebel in the classic sense. Your rebellion was allowing yourself to realize what your life was really like.
My rebellion was setting rules, was having...
Cleaning the house when your mom
was
gone.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And it's a fascinating thing that there is a bit of a syndrome that if children aren't given rules, they will often find them themselves. I could stay up until any time I wanted. I could go anywhere I wanted. And I became very disciplined because I didn't want the chaotic life that I saw both of my parents leading. I wanted a career. I wanted a paycheck. I wanted to pay the bills. I was tired of being kicked out. My parents gave me a wonderful love of education and a sense of self-esteem. They never gave me any discipline. And so I found that myself.
I know that you were pretty young when your younger brother was born. Do you remember anything about how they cared for you guys as infants? Because there's no ignoring a crying baby.
Oh, my mother would disagree with you. She said, you kids never cried once. I've seen her around a crying baby. She doesn't hear it. It's fascinating to me. My mother just blocks out things she doesn't want to know. When my brother had a baby, he brought her to my mother, and my mother gave her a sharp knife to play with. And my brother was ballistic. And mom said, don't worry, she cuts herself, she'll learn about sharp knives. And this is the way I was raised. I don't advocate this. Somebody told me that my book was on a bestseller list about parenting. I was like, no. This is not a parenting guide. There might be lessons to learn, but this is not a how-to. We learned very early on things that you do and you don't do. I don't recommend this, but I did get some tough lessons very early, and I have to say I personally feel that a lot of them served me very well. When I was on my own at a pretty early age, I never felt overwhelmed or daunted. It didn't seem that difficult to go to New York City on my own when I was 17 years old and get a couple of jobs. The fact that I didn't know anybody, it just didn't bother me. The fact I got mugged a number of times, I got beat up wherever I lived. I'm tough, and that's one of my blessings. I did not have a safety net, and that's okay. They say what doesn't kill you will make you stronger. That's Nietzsche, of course, but I disagree. It can also wound you, and a lot of people go around crippled with a chip on their shoulder or angry. That's the challenge, is to get past whatever slight or grievance you might have and to find the blessings in the worst experiences.
When you write either, I guess your fiction has been somewhat fictionalized accounts of things that still happen to people that you knew.
Yes.
But I wonder about the detachment and the engagement that you need emotionally as you're writing, and whether they're different when you are specifically trying to recall a scene that occurred within your life and when you are trying to sort of create something from imagination that happens to another character.
You know, I've come to understand... I made the move into fiction with great trepidation because I don't think of myself as a fiction writer. And it took me a while to understand that a lot of fiction writers don't make things up, that we steal shamelessly from real life, that the characters are largely based, if not on one person, but a composite of characters. Whenever I feel stuck about something, I don't make things up. I turn to real life and see what does somebody like my character do in a situation like that. I really don't have that much imagination. My slim little talent, such as it is I'm the nosiest human being alive. I love human drama. I love figuring people out. What motivates people? What makes them scared? What makes them want to move ahead? And life is so rich with characters. And if you just open your eyes and open your ears, there are so many amazing stories. And I think that is a mistake that a lot of writers make, is they look around. Where is an interesting story around me? Look inside. Don't be looking out to other worlds. It's right around you. A very talented artist who I know said, So many of us want to be more than who we are. He said true art is being what you really are. It is finding that truth. And whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction, whether it's science fiction or something based in the past, we all dig inside. That is where our inspiration comes from. That is where our realities come from. But at the same time, you turn to other people for the characters. What is this person like? I could never make up these people in my book. Some people have that talent. I don't.
I think about how many stories John Irving has created with whatever strange set of circumstances really shaped him early in life. They show up in every novel and they're always different.
Yes. And he takes those experiences and makes them his own. And you put the spin, you don't run out of these things. Life has this incredible, it just keeps giving you these gifts, these inspirations. And just when I think things are getting boring, something wacky happens. And my first reaction is, wow. I can use this. And you don't want to steal. You don't want to be unsympathetic. You don't want to exploit anybody. But I've come to understand that, look at John Steinbeck. He interviewed people for The Grapes of Wrath. Hemingway, everything he wrote about was something that happened to him. You think Dickens made that stuff up? He went to poorhouses and interviewed people. Those characters could not have been pulled out of thin air. You go and ask people, why did you do this? What happened? How did you feel about it? As a journalist, you know this, that there's people are so complicated. And if you can get those contradictions, the good and the bad, the fear and the bravery that all exist within each of us, that is what makes people real.
What do you think about when you're reading somebody else's novel?
Well, it entirely depends on...
Or memoir.
I'm often jealous. I'm like, wow, that's good. That's good. How did they do that? Where did that come from? What motivated them to go this way? So I probably read differently than most people, but I'm just constantly thinking, I see what they're doing. That's good. That's good. I sometimes like even writing that I think isn't entirely successful because you know what it is that they're trying to do and you want to talk to them. What if you'd done it this way instead? So you're always second guessing or congratulating the writer.
Sometimes when I pass a homeless person on the street, it will sort of hit me in the face, like this used to be someone's baby. Yes. And I like to assume that maybe they were cared for and you know, soothed and cried over. But this, you know, sweet baby, an adorable child grew into something, someone who was very challenged and maybe was harder for people to take in and care for. Your book reminded me that some of these people that we see are somebody's mother, somebody's father. And I wonder what it feels like for you to see a homeless person on the street.
Sometimes people ask me if my parents are typical of homeless people. And there's no such thing as a typical homeless person. There's as many reasons for being homeless as there are homeless folk. I do a lot of work on behalf of homeless people. And they are divided into two groups, the situationally homeless and the chronically homeless. Mm-hmm. The situationally homeless were displaced by Katrina or something like that. The chronically homeless people, and that's just my parents. And I have to say that if you do work in a homeless shelter or you spend a lot of time with homeless people, the pity is often replaced with admiration and affection. That some of these people are so smart and so kind. And what I would ask of people who pass a homeless person is to just remember that it is a human being. And to give them a nod, just to let them know that you see them as a human being. Because that is the hardest thing, I think, of not just homelessness, but poverty, is the lack of respect, the loss of self-respect. And people feel that they're just, that nobody sees them as a human being. And you spend a lot of time around homeless people and you see how complicated their lives are, their stories are. So when I pass a homeless person, I just always smile at them and ask how they're doing. And sometimes people are a little bit far gone and they don't, not really in a place where they can communicate with you. But so often they're grateful for the acknowledgement. I've spoken to a lot of people who've taken it upon themselves to try to rescue a homeless person. And they often find it very frustrating because they think, oh, well, all this person needs is a path, mm-hmm. is the help to get out. And there are no simple answers. And there are wonderful, wonderful shelters who try to work with people where they are and work around some of these problems that people have. Very often it's mental illness, drug abuse. But homelessness is very seldom just as simple as not having a home. The homelessness is usually not the problem. It's the result of another problem. And so you need to address that problem first. And it is typical for us to try to compartmentalize, oh, the homeless problem, how do we solve it? No, no, no. You need to solve the problem that made this person homeless.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Diane in Highland Village. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Yes, I really enjoyed Glass Castle, and I heard Jeanette on Diane Rehm when the book came out, and I remember a caller said, I don't believe a thing you wrote in this book, and I really admired how well Jeanette dealt with the caller and not getting defensive or anything like that. But I was wondering if that happens, how often that happens, where someone will read the book and say that he or she doesn't believe what happened in the book?
I love that question, and I love it that you remember that interview. That was the very first interview that I'd done after having written this book. That was so, I was so horrified by revealing these deep, dark secrets to the world, and then have the very first reaction, I don't believe it happened to you. It was a little bit bizarre. It was sort of funny. Really? Why would I make that up? It's embarrassing to me. If I wanted to make something up, wouldn't I make myself heroic instead of just some white trash, you know, homeless person? And it doesn't happen that often, but it does happen from time to time that people say, I don't believe a thing in your book. In fact, somebody on Amazon went on and was challenging my book, and it made me a little bit livid. They said, if she got caught on fire, where are the scars? And I was a little livid, because say I'm a bad writer, say that that you don't like my book, say that I'm ugly, whatever you want to say about me, but don't call me a liar, because that is all I have. That is my story. So I went online and responded to that. But one of the funny things to me is that I've heard a couple of times, oh, I just refuse to believe that there's poverty like that in America in the 1960s and 70s. And, you know, bless their heart, but they really might want to do a little volunteer work from time to time, because poverty existed like that not only in the 60s and 70s, but today as well. And
you can drive through neighborhoods in this city now and see it.
And see it, yes. And that's one of my missions, is to say, I'm sure you're a lovely person, but yes, this is true. You know, that the fact that you don't believe it just says something about your life. And so let's open up your world a little bit more. For every time that somebody challenges my story, there will be somebody in the audience or someone who's able to say, I believe her story because mine is the same. Hmm. So that is one of the wonderful things about going around and talking about these things. In certain people's eyes, they just, it's not that they're bad people, but they've got on blinders. They don't want to see.
I wonder if some of it has to do with the fact that you are, I don't normally comment on this, but you're very attractive. And you know, these days you carry yourself, and it's clear that you have assets. And I wonder if people assume that they can look at you and understand you just based on the sort of image that you present to the world, and can't imagine that there would be something else behind that.
That's very funny. There's a funny perspective, and thank you, I'm blushing. I don't see myself that way. I still see myself as the knock-kneed, dirty little kid from up in the hollers. But I think that there's some truth to what you say, that people make snap judgments based. And I worked very hard on presenting a different image. And one time when I was working at a magazine in New York, I said something to somebody, and I must have been a little, it must have seemed condescending, and because she took umbrage, and she said, that's very easy for you to say, living in your upper class world, being rich like you are, what would you know about people like me? And I was like, wow, I've passed, haven't I? I wasn't angry. I was just elated. People actually think that, you know, that they don't see the white trash anymore. So perhaps there is some of that. But again, I don't know whether to be flattered or, you know, I just met somebody earlier today, and she was so polished and beautiful and sweet, and she told me she wants to work with disabled children. My first reaction was, you're too glamorous to work with disabled. So we all stare. I can't get mad at people for stereotyping me, because I do it to other people.
There's a scene in your book where you've just arrived in New York and you're meeting a friend of your sister's, and you said something to him like, I was just funning you. And I wonder if you, what you sounded like when you left Welch, and if you deliberately worked on the way your voice sounds.
I did work on getting rid of the accent. I've got a bit of a tin ear, so I admire you people in radio who are so eloquent. I've been told that I slip in and out of my accent, especially sometimes when I'm doing my presentations, that I, when I'm talking about living back in West Virginia, I slip back into my West Virginia accent.
Was it something that you thought, this is going to hold me back, or you just didn't hear anyone else talking like that?
Oh, yeah. No, I just did not want people to look at me and know a thing about me. I never tried to pass myself off as a Rockefeller. I never tried to pretend I was somebody that I didn't. I certainly dressed differently. Now, I'll tell you something else interesting is that the book has been published in a number of countries, as you mentioned, and a number of people have told me that this story is a very American story. Not the poverty, that could happen anywhere, but completely remaking yourself like that. I think it was, Scott Fitzgerald said, there are no second acts in America. And I beg to differ. I'm sorry. America is all about second acts and reinventing yourself. And shame on me for not being a little bit more proud of that. And I think America does embrace people who pull themselves up by the bootstraps and the Horatio Alger stories. But those of us with the raggedy past sometimes have real trouble leaving that behind and not going around without a chip on our shoulder and thinking, I'm not as good as other people.
There are four siblings in your family.
Yes.
Everyone is going to respond to living in the same household in a different way.
So true. So true. If any of my siblings had written the book, it would have been very different. I am probably the optimist of the family. My brother is the realist. my older sister is much more of an escapist, an artist. And she's always retreated into, even when we were reading, it was fantasy and science fiction that she always gravitated towards. I've always loved nonfiction, and the fiction that I love is very close to nonfiction. And my kid sister did not fare as well, and I don't know why. There are many theories. Maybe she was so much younger, she never got my father's good years. Some people think because the neighbors took care of her, she didn't learn the resiliency. I don't know. Sometimes you get a lovely upper middle class family and one sibling just doesn't do as well as the other. But that is one of the challenges with sitting down and telling the truth, is my truth is not necessarily somebody else's. Without your lying, is my perspective true?
It's just different.
It's just different. And trying to figure out the degree to which you kid yourself, the degree to which you protect yourself with humor, with laughing at things, or just not going there. And it took me a while to go into those dark corners.
We're speaking this hour with author Jeanette Walls. Her memoir is called The Glass Castle. She has novels Half Broke Horses and The Silver Star. She'll speak tonight as the keynote address speaker at the Highland Park Literary Festival. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. SMU Summer Youth has hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration opens March 3rd at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the author of the memoir The Glass Castle and the novels Half Broke Horses and The Silver Star. Jeanette Walls is scheduled to be the keynote speaker tonight at the Highland Park Literary Festival. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Do you ever allow yourself to speculate on what would have happened with your parents had they married someone else?
Oh, yeah. I think about it all the time. I really wonder. And I wonder what I would have been like if I'd had a more privileged childhood. Would I have been a mean girl? Would I have been one of the people who picked on me? I don't know. And it's a fascinating, if my mother had married somebody who was more stable, if my father had. Usually when you read one of these memoirs, you have a stable parent. The mother or the father is really great and the other one's crazy. But both of my parents were completely chaotic and irrational. And I do wonder, there's no resentment. I think I'm the luckiest person in the world. I cannot believe how good my life is. I have so many wonderful things. I can go to a grocery store and buy anything I want. I have indoor plumbing. I got a great life. So I think about these things, not with anger or resentment, but how would I be different? And honestly, I wouldn't trade it. I wouldn't trade it. I have an amazing second husband. He's fantastic. He was raised in some wealth. He grew up with servants, for gosh sakes. And when we encounter rough times, as everybody does. I'll say, honey, you get us through this one. You're the tough one. And he taught me how to ski and how to sail and do all those nice waspy things. But when times get tough, this is nothing, John. We'll get through this. This is no big deal. And I think great blessings come with hardships if you're willing to receive it. So I do wonder if somebody might have been able to straighten out my father and get him to stop drinking. And I had a fantasy. To this day, I wonder if Dad came back in my old wizened state with knowing all that I do, could I get him to stop drinking? No. Could I straighten my mom out? She still makes me nuts. My mother's, you know,
she lives on your property now.
Yes, I built her a house, and I've come to realize she was a hoarder, and I didn't know this because our house was all the time burning down. And I have these knockdown, drag out fights with her, trying to get her to throw things away. You cannot control other people. You cannot change people who don't want to be changed. So you accept them, and that doesn't mean approve. It doesn't even mean forgive, because I don't like the concept of forgiveness. That means, I mean, in certain situations it's appropriate, but not for mine. How can I forgive my parents for being who and what they are? My mother can't take care of herself. How could she possibly take care of me? I believe she gave me incredible gifts. They gave us the love of education of art, I mean, geology, astronomy, everything. Everything was always an adventure, always looking on the bright side of things. I think I got incredible gifts. Some people who read my story think it's a tragic story of deprivation, child neglect, and even child abuse. And sometimes I'll sit in a classroom and there's this heated debate, and some of the students will think that my parents should have been arrested and locked up and thrown away. And other people say, I'm a little jealous. She had such freedom, or the parents were always there for her. And you know something? They're both right. And that's the conversation I love having, is what is good and what is bad, and let's discuss it. And what can we take from the good, and how can we prevent the sort of bad? And does it even matter? I mean, would I be the same person? I don't know.
I guess the thing about acceptance is that it's a little bit like forgiving every single day for the rest of your life.
I think it's also just rejoicing in what you have. It's not forgiveness. It's just sort of like, this is who and what they are. And if I want it to change, I'm going to be frustrated. It's not that I'm a good person. Yeah. It's that I'm a pragmatist. My brother got together with my mom and tried to get her to apologize for the way we were raised. And I said, Brian, it's not going to happen. And it didn't. And it was a long and painful conversation in which she ended up saying I did the best I could. And I kind of believe that. My mom is a very joyful person. And she sees the beauty in everything. And she doesn't hear crying babies. And she never will. And so if I wanted to cry, it wasn't going to get me anywhere. And you know where that got me? I said, I never cry now. And I have great difficulty asking for help. And that's one of my issues. I'm pathologically independent. And it was kind of a revelation for me that people will help you. But there was a lot to be gained from that as well. I'm not a quitter. I'm pretty tough. And that is both good and bad. But it's gotten me pretty far. I have no complaints. So how could I forgive? How could I be angry with my parents for the way I was raised when I have so much more than I ever dreamed of having? Where is the forgiveness or even the difficulty in accepting this? I rejoice in it.
Is your mother a good artist?
That's such a judgment.
Do you think your mother is a good artist?
I think that her landscapes, she's a lovely colorist.
It's funny how careful you're being about answering this question.
There's an exuberance. My mother's art is all over the place. There's scary clowns. There's abstract falling down buildings. I think her flowers are beautiful. The scary clowns, they don't do it for me. But then sometimes people have come to buy her art and they like the things that I don't like. She never sells it. She keeps her art. But I grew up with this art and I'm not a good judge of it. I'm just not.
Would it mean something different if you could say, would it matter to you if you could say, she's spectacularly brilliant, like maybe she's undiscovered, but I'm quite sure that it was worth her focusing on this and not the sort of day-to-day needs of children.
Mom doesn't, that's not her focus. She doesn't care about that. And the fact that she enjoys creating art is what's important to her. This is not about me. This is not about what I want her to be.
Yeah.
It's about who and what she is. And she's the happiest person I've ever known. My father was a spectacularly good writer, which I didn't even know until after he died. He had this big box of writing. He wrote beautifully. And that didn't get him anywhere either. So what matters is I cannot change these people. This is not about me. I can't dictate who and what they should be. They gave me gifts. And maybe I didn't have what I wanted, but I got what I needed. And I got so much more than so many people who had much more materially than I did. When I first sat down to write The Glass Castle, I wanted to write more about the people I got to know in New York City who had so much, but there was something missing in their lives. Their very well-to-do parents had the nannies take them over for the summer. And I think that that can be more damaging than having crazy, wacky parents who are always there for you. But who am I to say? It sounded like I was making fun of rich people, so I just left that out. The story was about me, not me making fun of rich people.
You would be within your rights to say this is none of my business. But I wonder sometimes about people who have had very unusual or challenging childhoods being more hesitant than the average person to have children.
I don't think that's none of your business at all. I think nothing's off limits. There's something called parented children, and it means if you take on more adult responsibilities as a child, you're less inclined to want to have children. I always thought I would have children. I like kids. I've never been that driven maternally. It's not this thing that ever overwhelmed me. I remember very vividly being 13 years old when I had to take over the household when my mother went AWOL for a while. And I'm thinking, this is really hard. This being a mom stuff, feeding the kids. I thought I could be a better mom than my mother. And I thought I could get my dad to stop drinking. And I couldn't.
You were 13.
And I remember thinking, I am not going to do this until I get my ducks in a row. The ducks never get in a row. It would have been a mistake to have had children with my first husband. My second husband already has a daughter, and I didn't get married to him until I was 40. There's no regrets, but I do wonder what kind of parent I would be. Would I be strict and try to prevent my children from going through what I did, or would I force them to toughen up and go through it? I don't know. I have nieces and nephews from my husband's side. Those up the wazoo. I love my nieces and nephews. I don't know how I would be. Of four children, the three girls, none of us had children. I don't think that's a coincidence. My brother's the best dad in the world. And he said becoming a parent made him less sympathetic to mom and dad. He said it's not that difficult to feed your kids. He became a teacher, a ninth grade English teacher, after he retired from being a cop. And he said becoming a teacher made him appreciate mom and dad more. He was teaching in a rough area, and he said what some of those kids were not given by their parents blew him away. Because I cannot remember not knowing how to read. They taught us to read, to draw, to think from a very early age. There was never a time that I went to my father and asked him a question that he didn't spend time not only answering it but exploring it with me. And that's extraordinary. That's extraordinary. So I don't know why I didn't have children. No regrets, no reason. Though I do kind of wonder what kind of parent I would be. And I have so many friends, though, who say, they had no idea it would be this hard. No idea it would be this rewarding either.
When you think about let me just ask you this first. What did your father write about?
Unfortunately, my mother was the one who kept his writing, and there are no sequential pages. So I could only see a page at a time. He was a beautiful, beautiful writer, very lean and muscular, sort of Hemingway-esque. And the stories I gather were just kind of Hemingway-esque as well, just people struggling to make something happen, and it wasn't destined to happen.
When you think about your life being presented on screen, there's talk of a movie now,
yes,
right?
Yes,
and
yes.
Jennifer Lawrence is attached to play you.
Yes, yes.
I mean, does it make you nervous? Do you just have to kind of let go and think this is going to be a different thing?
You kind of let go. It was originally with Paramount, and I thought, I don't care what they do. They can do whatever they want, because that is usually the case unless you're a very big deal writer. You don't have control over your movie. So they can make me a hoochie dancer for all I care. As long as they make it into a movie, I'm happy. And then I saw an early screenplay, and I wasn't that happy with it. And I thought, even I have standards. And it's now with a lovely, lovely producer at Lionsgate, and they're endeavoring to be very true to the story. Jennifer Lawrence is not only supposedly going to star in it, she's also an executive producer, and she wants to be very true to the story. They get it, and that's what makes me happy. So you kind of let go and just trust them.
Let's go to, let's see, we have an email here, and it is from Lorinda, who says, thank you for writing The Glass Castle. I share echoes of trouble in my life from time to time as a child. I found hearing your story set many emotions free in me to cry and to ultimately celebrate the self-determined path that you created for yourself.
Now, that's beautiful. That's what it's all about for me, is so many people have stories and struggle with it and think that they're alone. And hearing somebody else's stories, it is the magic of storytelling. It opens up other people and makes them think, you know something? There are other people out there like me.
I guess we all carry around the events of our lives with us at all times, mm-hmm. right? So if you're 44, you're walking around with 44 years of experiences. It must be strange, though, that you sort of completed what sounds like a really cathartic process a decade ago, and you continue to meet people who have just connected with this material. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if it ever feels, I can tell you think it feels like a blessing, but I wonder if it's ever something that sort of wearies you a little bit.
No, it never. I had this amazing experience with some kids earlier today where they talked to me about their lives, and I teared up, and I can't believe how lucky I am. And people say it must be weird having all these people talking about you, knowing all these things. It's the opposite of weird. You don't have to pretend you're somebody you're not. But moreover, I met a couple of people today I'd never laid eyes on before, and they threw their arms around and say, I feel like you're my best friend. And that they can say that, and that these kids can come up and talk to me, it's never a burden. But here's the other thing. It's not about me. It's not. If people who come and listen to me tonight leave thinking about me, I haven't done my job. My job is to make them think about their stories. And everybody brings their own story to mine, whether they're angry with my parents or they think I have great parents. It's a Rorschach test, as everything in life is. You look at it and what you go, some people think it's a tragedy, some think it's very comic, some think it's inspiring, some think it's all three. And they're all right. It's never been weird or upsetting. I will confess that when the news of the book suspension first broke in Dallas, I was concerned just because I just didn't want the story to get stopped from being told. I don't want to be labeled a troublemaker. That's not what I'm about. I'm about getting people to talk and to feel better about their stories. I'm not one of these people who enjoys shocking or upsetting people. I want people like Lorinda to open up about, to come to terms with her story.
Books by my guest, author Jeanette Walls, include the memoir The Glass Castle and the novels Half-Broke Horses and The Silver Star. She'll be the keynote speaker tonight at the Highland Park Literary Festival. Jeanette, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Alan Roberts. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.